Welcome to Business Talk with Megan McNulty, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of business success and reveals the strategies, insights, and stories that drive these professionals to thrive in the ever-evolving world of business. Whether you're an established entrepreneur, a seasoned business owner, or simply fascinated by the world of commerce, this podcast is your front row seat to learn from the best. Each episode, Megan will bring you engaging interviews with professionals from diverse industries who will share their triumphs, lessons learned, and the insights they've gained along the way. Hi, Brandon. How are you doing?
Hey, Megan, how's it going?
Good. Good to talk to you again. There's a lot
going on in the world.
And so I'm so excited to have this conversation. So basically, there's so much talk about what's happening in the Middle East right now. And I feel, even though I keep up with the news, read, et cetera, I have no idea what's going on. It's very, I think, hard to understand the complexity of the situation. So I just wanted to have a conversation today about what's happening in the Middle East, especially since October 7th and with Israel and the situation in that region. And I was hoping maybe we could start with the light history so we kind of can put bookmark ends around our conversation today.
Yeah, absolutely. I first of all, I want to thank you so much for having me back, and I look forward to discussing this. And I'm going to just repeat what I just said in the preface to this, because I fully believe that with the condition that Americans are in mentally and emotionally, and the lack of political discourse, the lack of general education on subjects, and just the, you know, hypersensitivity and immense amount of anger that I see from all sides. The only way we're going to know we did a good job in this podcast is if both sides are equally mad at us at the end. And I think the reality is there are fundamental objective truths about human existence, which we have to acknowledge, which is that all human beings have a right to exhibit and to live their freedom. And I think fundamentally what we try to do as human beings is to create an environment that we believe will expand that freedom. And if we're not doing that, it's something that we want to be doing. And it's certainly the most fundamental part of what being American is we created a government and a culture around the idea of individual freedom, and that we wanted to create this government to preserve that freedom and expand it for as many people as possible. And we have been continually trying to live up to that. And so let's get into the first question.
So why is Israel so important to the United States? And how did it come about?
Yeah, so a number of things. First, I'm gonna take an angle at this that I don't think most people have heard. And I think I'm going to jump right into the deep end, into the controversy of all of this. I believe in purpose and not just process, right? Why does something exist? What is its purpose? And I believe that, like I said just a minute ago, but more so, is that the fundamental purpose of cultures, and there's a reason why people aren't living individually isolated around the globe without sight or sound of another human being. No, we've developed, you know, familial identities, and then clan, tribal identities, and then eventually got into civilizations, and now nation states and countries. And there is a reason why human beings have this need or desire to be around each other. But what's the purpose? What's the value of these cultures and civilizations? And fundamentally, a metaphysical part of human existence is this desire to be free and to live this free and to prosper and to have the ability to succeed and to grow and to, you know, live a better life yourself, but also for posterity, for the next generation. Everybody wants their kids. I've been, as I've mentioned on the last podcast, to 110 countries. I've never been to a country where parents didn't want a better life for their kids, or parents didn't want, you know, the ability to be able to provide for their family, and so on and so forth. And what I would say, sorry.
Or safety.
Or
They want to
safety,
feel
safety and
safe, yeah.
security. Absolutely. And so everybody would think, well, if everybody wants that, why do we have so much trouble, getting along, or why are there all these wars and conflicts? And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but I want to get to the quintessential reason why I think Israel and the Jewish population as a whole, which is global, right? And I think there's an important distinction to make here, which is that Judaism as a religion, you have so many different ethnic groups to include, ethnic African Ethiopians who are Jewish, or people from different parts of the world, Russian Jews, and on and on and on, of people all over the world who are Jewish. So making a distinction between the religion and the ethnic identity, and then the nationality today of Israel, but also that comes from the Israelites in the original 12 tribes of Israel, is that I fundamentally believe that the contribution that the Jewish people and Israel has given as an example to the world is the value of believing in a cultural identity and passing that on from generation to generation, almost without question. And everybody assumes, and this is going to get into a little bit why I think people hate Jews and hate Israel, but anywhere in the world, whether it be in politics in Washington or Hollywood or finance, at the top of these industries, you will find people who are either of Jewish descent or practicing Jews or of some kind of relationship to the state of Israel and Judaism writ large. And I think what's really fascinating about that, and what's telling, is that this is not a coincidence. You don't have a group of people who, throughout their entire history of thousands of years they have existed, has been either enslaved or tried to be exterminated by some kind of ruling power or some kind of authoritarian in either the Middle East or in Europe or wherever it is, and still seem to succeed, still seem to be educated, successful doctors, lawyers, financiers everywhere in the world. And I fundamentally believe, I'm not Jewish, but I'm a Zionist. I fundamentally believe in the state of Israel and its contribution to the world as it comes to a culture that produces productive, successful individuals in the world. And I think that's something to admire and to aspire to. And I think right now, as Americans who are really floundering in what it means to be an American and what is our cultural identity, we could learn something from the state of Israel and Judaism as a religion, and how they protect, perpetuate, and continue to carry on their cultural tradition from generation to generation, ensuring that they preserve fundamental values of success, family, faith, belief. So I think that's why Israel is important to America.
Okay, so right now we have, I guess, correct me because I don't know, and that's why we're talking. So Israel was, so around World War, like World War I, World War II, what exactly happened with Israel and Palestinians?
Yeah, okay. I think to take this back to kind of a very, very brief inception, right? Judaism, as we know it as a religion, came from Yahwehism, which was a monotheistic religion, meaning you're believing in one God, which was unique at that time. There were very few examples of this. And this was literally thousands of years before Christianity. And even, Christianity was 610 years before, or approximately before, Islam. So when you talk about the Israelites and the tribes of Israel, modern day Palestinians historically come from the area of Canaan, and so do the Israelites. But as an identity and as a culture, Judaism predates it by thousands of years. And so you have to understand that if I just looked at, 10 random people in any city in America, and I said, "Hey, this land belongs to those people," your first question would be, "Who are those people?" And it is not realistic to equate the modern Judaistic culture and identity that dates back thousands of years to modern day Palestinians. There's absolutely no parallel because Judaism as an identity, as a culture, existed long before Islam. And as you can see today, particularly via Hamas, which we'll get into the 1988 covenant of Hamas, which was their declaration to the world of what their intentions were, it is fundamentally, and it says it in the document, an Islamic document that is governed under Sharia law and the belief of Islam. So if that is your entire identity, if that is everything that you believe, well, you didn't believe it when Judaism first came to inception. In fact, you didn't believe it until thousands of years after that. So from an identity and cultural basis, there is no way to equate these two people, even though they may have existed in the same land and territories of Canaan. I think to your question about what happened after World War II and the creation of the modern state of Israel, you know, there are a lot of documents or declarations and procedures that went into, you know, agreeing to the creation of this state. But I think what's important to understand about this is that it is not as if there were not Jews and descendants of the Israelites in this region when the state of Israel was created. Absolutely there were. And so Right. It's not like there was no Jews in, you know, what people refer to as, you know, Transjordan or, you know, Palestine, the name that it had at that time, which it had previous names of the Kingdom of Israel and, you know, all of these other things previously. But the name does not mean that there were no Jews there. So fundamentally what ended up happening post-World War II, after of like 10 million Jews that existed in Europe, 6 million were murdered, it was made very clear that this needs to be rectified and that there needs to be a state of Israel created. And for political reasons, the world, you know, really galvanized support to be able to create the modern state of Israel.
So we have the modern, so that we're post-World War II now, we have the modern state of Israel. And I think what maybe a lot of Americans unfortunately don't understand is what, when that was created, what now we have the Palestinians, how are they occupying Gaza? What does that look like? Why is Gaza so important? And maybe lead us into how then Hamas comes about.
Yeah. And I think there's another part to this that's really important. There are 3 million Arab, therefore Muslim, Israelis, right? They have Israeli passports and they are citizens of the state of Israel, and there's 3 million of them. So it's really important to understand, you know, the first time I was in the West Bank was in 2006, and I've been back and forth to Israel and the region kind of since then. And so it's very important to understand that there are Arab Muslims and, you know, Jewish Israelis who are both, I guess, nationally Israeli, who have business together, live together peacefully in the same towns, in the same villages every single day, and there are no problems. So I think what's important to understand is that there has to be a intellectual distinction, and this distinction is in the nuance, it's in the details. And this is why we fail a lot as Americans, but I think generally speaking today in society is that we don't want to bother ourselves with the details. I just want to pick a side, whichever side seems either more comfortable or convenient without worrying about the details, and I'm going to support that side almost Right. To, you know, a violent fault. Is it This really has nothing to do with Islam. You know, and a lot of conservatives over the years I've experienced, you know, want to villainize Islam and say it's Islam's fault and Islam's terrible and it's a terrible religion. And it's utter nonsense. I've lived in the Muslim world for years and years and years. I've trained Muslims to fight. I've fought alongside them. I've depended my lives on them. And it has nothing to do with Islam. It has everything to do with people using Islam as an ideological basis for manipulating those who have no control over their life, they have no future, they have no opportunity due to the conditions and environments. And then when you have nothing, it's very easy to feel like you have no power over yourself, you have nothing to lose. So What does it matter if I'm violent? What does it matter if I, you know, take extreme measures? Because I've got nothing else to lose. And I used to tell people in Washington that if I was a 17-year-old in Raqqa when ISIS showed up, I would have joined ISIS. Because I know who I am as a person and how it must have felt to live in a city where you had no schools, no development, no jobs, and you had been subjugated by a Ba'athist, Shia, Alawite dominated government in Damascus, and then a Sunni, you know, guy with a big beard shows up on the back of a horse saying, you're gonna be a good Muslim, I'm gonna give you a wife and a rifle, and you're gonna fight for the caliphate. You don't know any better, and this is the first time you've ever been given anything in your life. Of course I'm gonna join. And so I think what's important to understand is that there is a very important distinction to make between the people of Palestine, the Palestinian people, the innocent women and children, and Hamas. And what Hamas has been able to do to either leverage, use, or manipulate the situation for their own purposes at the expense of the Palestinian people and making Israel a target. And I think you can see a lot of that. Hamas does not care how many Palestinians die. They care about their ideological objectives, and they care about achieving those at any cost. And I think that's really terrible, because there are obviously innocent civilians inside of the Palestinian controlled areas that have died, been killed, been subjugated, and suffered due to the current circumstances. And many instances have been given for Hamas to be able to do something in their best interests. But in their mind, the more Palestinians suffer or die, the better case they have for their ideological objectives. And I think that's really terrible. You asked, how did we get to where we are? What's really important to understand, and this is a very important distinction to make about Hamas, and you know, you'll read articles, people have made parallels to ISIS and Hamas. I think, and they'll say, oh, there's no comparison, you can't make the comparison. I think it's actually less in the favor of Hamas to make that comparison, because unlike ISIS, Hamas was elected. Their objectives, ideologically, intellectually, by using Islam as a justification for violence and the murder of others, which is not true Islam, is exactly like ISIS. And they have made it very clear in their covenant in 1988 that they want to expel the entire region of all Jews. And as long as the Christians stay out of the way, they might spare them. But their objectives are homicidal. And they're very clear about that. And then they rewrote it in 2017 because they realized that wasn't really a good look. And you can tell by their activity and their actions, which we'll get into on October 7th to put that into context. But that is their objectives do not allow for anybody to be able to live or exist in parallel with them without being subjugated by their ideology. And so Ariel Sharon actually left Gaza in 2005 after they were elected and said, okay, if you guys want Hamas to be your leadership, we're gonna leave, we're gonna let you do your thing. And so from 2005 until October 7, Hamas was allowed to govern Gaza under the ways that they were, you know, elected to do so. And the result was October 7th.
How, so the Palestinian people actually elected Hamas into power over Gaza?
Correct. Correct.
So there's no leadership in Palestine that says, no, we don't want, like, why are they electing Hamas? Like, why do these people think that should be their leaders?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think that it's a very complicated answer that has to do with, you know, when you have a leadership of a people who look right across the fence or the demarcation line of into Israel and say, our ultimate goal is to kill all of you. It's non-negotiable. You can either kill yourselves or we're going to do it. It's very hard for you to then look at Israel and expect them to be like, okay, well, why aren't you, you know, being kinder and being gentler and allowing more development and allowing more progress in the space? And I'm not going to say that Israel hasn't made significant mistakes. Most of those mistakes are because They're basically looking at a population that has told them they all have to be exterminated from the planet. And so you're like, well, they've proven that they're willing to do that. They're telling us that's what they want to do. So how can we then be criticized for not, putting up fences and putting up guards and restricting their maneuverability when we know that they're smuggling weapons in and training people to fight and training people to kill? And October 7th was the proof of that. So when you ask a question, why did the people elect Hamas? I think at that time, the Palestinian Authority, which was still in control of the West Bank, was seen to be inefficient or ineffective and was not doing anything really to benefit the Palestinian people in the eyes of Allah. So they thought, well, maybe God, the Hamas will actually fight for us and defend us, not knowing that that's not exactly what they needed. What they needed was somebody who could help build good governance to create opportunity and commerce instead of trying to achieve some kind of homicidal objective under the guise of a hijacked Islam. And I think it has a lot to do with the conditions were very bad. They didn't know what else to do. They wanted some action, and these people looked like people of action, not people of talk. And so they elected them. And I'm
Right.
not entirely sure there aren't plenty of Palestinians in Gaza who are very aware that Hamas is no good for them and that this is a terrible, terrible set of circumstances. But you can see how it can end up in that space, how it can end
Right.
up in this
Yeah.
downward spiral of a situation.
But so how do the are the people of Palestine poor? Like, is it a poor, very poor country, like we see, and they're starving and.
It's hard for me to speak to the current situation on the ground now because I think that the international media has really done a disservice to everybody by really reporting, in my opinion, a lot of opinions guised as fact, right? And you'll see these things that people who know what's really going on, they'll say like, the Palestinian Health Ministry. There is no Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. There's only Hamas. They are the government. They control everything. But they don't want to say Hamas because they know Hamas is a designated terrorist organization. And so they use these words to kind of manipulate the optics in the favor of Hamas. And that doesn't mean, once again, that Israel hasn't made mistakes. I think that it's important for Americans to understand that in our war in Afghanistan, 60,000 Afghans died. 60,000 in a matter of 20 years. Thousands of Americans. We've had civilian casualties in every conflict that we've been in, even the ones where we didn't have substantial U.S. Presence on the ground and we were working through, partner forces on the ground. And this is a reality of war. This is the consequence of war and it's terrible and it shouldn't exist, but it does. And it's a reality. And unfortunately, I think what we have to acknowledge is that while we understand there is a moral objectivity to this, right? There is one party that is insisting on the death and the destruction of another one. The other one who has made concession after concession to try to agree to terms historically through, a number of accords from the period of Bill Clinton to, others throughout the time, throughout the period. And to the point where one of my old bosses, Vice Admiral Harris, or now former ambassador and then Admiral Harris retired, he was actually the military advisor to Hillary Clinton, and one of his primary responsibilities was the Palestinian-Israeli roadmap. And the U.S. has committed a lot of resources and time to trying to solve this problem. But when you have one side who does not want a solution without the end state being what they, and there are no accommodations and no agreements, what alternatives does everybody else have?
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing to the Business Talk podcast and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us grow and improve. Thank you for joining us today. This has been another episode of Business Talk with Megan McNulty.